there's no place like home for the holidays. And no matter how far away you roam, if you pine for the sunshine of a friendly gaze, for the holidays you can.
Welcome back to Horror for the Holidays, a Christmas horror movie podcast. I'm Jay Logsdon.
And I'm Jeff Searcy.
We have a special guest today.
Mr. Critters himself.
Hey guys, Matt Dupay here. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, all right, Matt's back.
He's back.
How have you been, Matt?
I've been doing great. How about you guys?
Well, doing good. Surviving. I mean, you're the one that gets to travel around the country going to all these horror conventions. Last week, you survived Minneapolis. Like, we that's the last time we saw you. Yep.
No, it's a great point. I've actually entered a hibernation writing period lately, which is kind of cool. So I don't pick back up on the traveling circuit till later this year, but hopefully get a lot more writing done, which I'm currently knee deep in, which is great.
I know. We'll talk about that at the end. Any things that you got brewing, percolating in there. But in the meantime, it's Easter, so I figured we'd talk about a movie that's almost an Easter movie.
Yes, we're getting close.
We'll talk about a real 80s crap fest. Let's talk about Critters. We'll decorate some eggs.
Ooh.
Released April 11th, 1986.
That's good.
Kind of could have potentially been Easter time. I don't know.
I mean, yeah.
It could have been right around
there. It's close. It's got to be close.
Yeah, it's better than some of the movies we've done. Written and directed by Stephen Herrick, who a look through his IMDb has like a pretty wild career. I want to say had like Critters, but then also had, I want to say it was like an Air Bud or something on there, and like some like children's movies. Like,
so a man
wild
of, man of two great franchises then.
And Air Bud's one of Jeff's favorites. Story and screenplay by Dominic Muir, who also wrote Ginger Dead Man's Evil Bongs and Puppet Masters of various levels. I think, Matt, maybe you can talk about this. I saw a new Ginger Dead Man came out last year.
Yeah, unfortunately, I lost track of the regeneration of that universe. But man, is that, or what a time to be alive.
I was so mad because I bought the Cookie Tin Deluxe Edition of all the movies, and then they released another one afterwards.
I hate it when that happens.
Additional scenes were written by Don Opper, who plays Charlie, and is in all four movies.
Yes.
Matt, I assume we don't talk about the fifth movie that came out a couple years ago?
I actually am probably one of the few that don't mind the fifth one.
Okay.
It does get a lot of hate, though, but I particularly don't hate it.
All right, well, we'll have you back. Then I guess we'll have you back for five episodes, or for four more episodes instead of three. I will have you back as many times as you want to come.
Thank you, guys.
Most importantly, Dee Wallace stars as Helen. We last saw her in Red Christmas. Oh, yeah. What a bad movie that was.
Oh, boy.
some Halloween spectacular. We'll see her in Rob Zombie's Halloween.
Oh, boy.
Billy Green Bush is her husband Jay, and was also in Jason Goes to Hell, The Final Friday.
Mm.
Nadine Vandervelt is their daughter April, and she is also in Munchies, which is also little guy's horror movie.
Excellent.
And most importantly, Scott Grimes plays one bad boy as their son Brad. Yes. He's bad. He's the best at being the worst.
It comes in handy. Sometimes you need a critter to fight some critters.
Yeah, he knows all about having aliens around. He's been dealing with that for like 19 seasons on Fox and TBS at That's various
true.
Times.
That's very true.
Emmett Walsh is Harv, the famous the Phantom himself, Slam Evil Billy Zane plays Steve. Ethan Phillips plays Jeff. So we've got both a Jay and a Jeff in this movie. We got a couple B-boys.
How could we not like it now?
All right. Immediately when I went, wait, there's a Jay and a Jeff? Oh, this is the greatest movie ever made. Terrence Mann is Ugg / Johnny Steele and will return as Ugg in subsequent releases of this movie. Lynn Shea plays Sally, and we will see her again in Dead End. And we'll also next year for Critters 2 with Matt Dupay. And Montrose Haggins, who plays organist, was a farm woman in Critters 2.
Of course.
So, you know, getting that Critters money.
I heard there's a lot of that to go around.
Roger Hampton plays Jake, and we last saw him as Patrolman 2 in Halloween 2.
Oh,
what a bad movie that was, too. The guy who plays Giant Critter, Kevin Thompson, is Little Person Elf in the episode Naughty List of American Horror Stories. That was took a long way to get to that.
That's a deep cut.
I think Danny Trejo plays a killer Santa.
Nice.
The legendary Chiodo brothers did the special effects and were also producers on Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Matt, this is your chance to talk about the Chiodo brothers, if you would like.
Oh, yeah. I've been very fortunate not only to interview them for the book several times, but I got to see them on the road at numerous events. And not only do they bring us Critters, you know, 1 through 4, but also, like you mentioned, Killer Clowns from Outer Space, which is an absolute milestone. But Team America, too. They did all the puppetry work on Team America, which is just fantastic. And I mean, deserves so much attention unto itself as just a comedic milestone so much later in their careers. It is very unfortunate that Killer Clowns from Outer Space, the sequel, never came to light in that era, not long after they finished the first one. And we're still in 2026 hoping that they kind of come back and introduce something in that universe. Besides that cool video game that they just released last year, the Killer Clowns from Outer Space video game, which is really cool.
No, Matt, I don't know if you know this about me. I work at a Spirit Halloween during the Halloween season, and some of that Killer Clown shit moves like crazy. Like, people are obsessed with that franchise. I don't know how you can't get a sequel made if you really, really wanted to. Like, it seems like easy money to make.
I totally agree. There were some really, really close moments where deals were actually signed. I think, I want to say, up until recently, even last year, there was talks of the sequel being funded by Big Hollywood on top of it. So hopefully we get to see that. I know they have a great vision for it, and I believe even more than just a sequel. Like a series as well. So something that's definitely on the forefront of their minds really ever since the first one came out, although they are kind of done, unfortunately for us, with Critters at this point.
I don't know. I think they got one more Critters in them at least.
I will say there's a brand new production company that's starting soon. After Shudder made the terrible decision to get rid of Joe Bob, he launched his own production company. So maybe Joe Bob could get on the horn and get that figured out. I don't know.
This is true. He loved the first one.
Jeff, this is probably the most important thing for you. Do you want to talk about who distributed the movie? Your favorite distribution company?
The greatest distribution company of all time, New Line Cinema, of course. Bringing you great franchises like The Lord of the Rings and Critters.
And it's the house Freddy built.
Yeah, well, yeah.
That guy too.
1.5 good movies, yeah.
$3 million budget, $13 million box office. This is a success any way you slice it.
Yeah.
Especially in 1980, what did I say, 1986 dollars?
Yes.
All right, yeah, this is a hit.
How could it not be?
Matt, I guess you'll have more time to talk about your personal experience later, but my personal experience for this movie is I probably saw it maybe once, like at one time. I think that's about it.
I believe my only personal experience with this was finding out that Matt was writing a book about it, and then looking up what Critters were. And then I do remember my dad not letting me rent Critters when I was like 12 years old, I think, because he's like, nah, there's way too much blood in that for you.
He's like, Jeff, we're a Ghoulies household. No Critters, only Ghoulies.
No, I was only allowed, as a child, I was only allowed to watch Chud 2.
Oh, Mike Lombardo's favorite movie. Yeah. I guess, Matt, what was your first exposure to the Critters universe?
Well, for me, this was one of those, I think, linchpin films. I was able to watch it right when, I'm pretty sure I was in third grade. If not, I was in fourth grade. And I got to see it like right, it was about a year or so after it came out, and it was a VHS watch for me at a birthday sleepover. And back then, I remember, I don't know whether it was the neighborhood I grew up in or just the era itself, but like everybody did group birthdays. Even if you didn't like the people, you would go to the birthday party. So I find myself like this one spring evening, it's like a Friday night, great, you know, kind of Friday night movie night setup, but we're at this kid's birthday party. It's a sleepover, and everyone had eaten, you know, 4 pounds of candy, and there's kids playing Nintendo, and there's another room set up where somebody, I think it was the kid's dad, had rented Critters. And I'll tell you, as soon as it came on, I was like transfixed the entire time and couldn't believe what I was watching, and loved every second of it. And then, you know, in the midst of the chaos, I ended up rewinding the tape and just watched it again, and finally fell asleep at like 2 a.m. So for me, it was one of those really pivotal horror films. I probably just watched it at the right exact moment where it really left an impression on me. And it never really left, you know, it was always in my subconscious and stuff. And honestly, it wasn't until years later, like 2010, I think it was. And an associate of mine mentioned it because he knew I liked horror movies. He just brought it up. He just kind of casually mentioned it. He's like, yeah, do you remember seeing this? I loved that movie as a kid. So for me, it just, you know, that many years later, it just stuck in my mind as like, okay, let me revisit this. Maybe there is something to you like share with the fandom and do a book on this possibly.
That's awesome. God.
You know, upon reflection, Jay, I think that it's not that, because based on the movies my dad let me watch at a younger age, I think he just didn't want to watch Critters.
I mean, yeah, there is the famous story of your dad letting you watch Nightmare on Elm Street or Halloween.
Nightmare on Elm Street when I was 7, yes.
Yeah. But, now, Critters is too bloody, but Nightmare on Elm Street, that's fine.
Yeah, I think my dad just did not want to watch Critters.
As a kid, like if I had seen this, I think it would have been the same way. Like, and I know, you know, Jeff, also a Star Wars person, like loved that original trilogy. If I had seen this movie with all the cool aliens, I would have been like, yeah, I'll watch more Critters. Like, this is fucking great. Like,
no, it's a great point. You know, for me, it wasn't anything I hadn't seen before. Like, I had seen a whole spectrum of horror. So it for me, I wasn't exposed to something, you know, that I wasn't allowed to see or anything for the first time. But it was just like I think the unique quality of it is it almost plays like a family movie of sorts in a horror sci-fi setting. And, you know, at the time, PG-13 ratings were incredibly new. No one really knew what the left-right boundaries were for them. And I mean, obviously, as we go forward into the 90s, that the whole ratings board is questionable at best. But, you know, when 13 had first come out, really everyone was like, well, how do we kind of engage with this? What's too much? What's not enough? And I do believe that Critters erred on the side of going lighter to make sure they got the 13 and not an R. So they cut a lot of the stuff that I think would have also been totally acceptable. And I know the writer was a little sad that some of his darker moments weren't included in it. More family members being killed, more blood. And even the second unit director shot some sequences with a ton of blood, particularly the Billy Zane death scene. They shot a whole night of footage that never made it into any of the final cuts.
Oh, man.
And, you know, there's critters kind of boring through his chest cavity. Mm-hmm. And there's this hay and blood and gore spraying everywhere, which is really fantastic to kind of think about had this been an R-rated film in the very beginning.
Is that footage still locked in a vault somewhere? Could we get an R-rated cut of Critters someday?
All right. So you bring up something really cool. Allegedly, the footage is kind of lost to history. So we really don't know. But I came into possession of a reel of, I think, 5 minutes. I got it. It's a long story of how I ended up getting this, but it's 5 minutes of footage, 35 millimeter, that had gone to, I believe, the Canadian version of a ratings board. Ooh. To see if they would allow this cut to be, you know, these were the scenes that were trimmed and or not trimmed enough. So perhaps on that reel, we will finally get to see some of the more bloodier sequences. I have not had the ability to screen that footage yet, but I believe this is one of the only loose reels floating around that has been discovered in the past 30 years, which is really cool.
I also very interesting that this is PG-13, you know, because it was, you know, the PGR split, and Gremlins, which is also a little guy movie, is the reason that PG-13 exists. Like, exactly. That's kind of an interesting dichotomy.
That's a great one. And, you know, with Gremlins as being such an anchor in Christmas horror, it to me, I think it's just a wonderful, you know, landmark for not only horror writ large, but Christmas horror, as well as this kind of larger notion of, you know, how far can we push stuff? And what actually is the difference between PG and R, and is there that weird kind of gray, like middle school zone area that we can kind of grade things a little more appropriately?
I mean, when what is it? Airplane has like full frontal nudity in it, and that's like a PG rated movie. Like, but PG-13, like, oh, you say fuck twice, and suddenly it's an R rating. Like, what are we doing here, guys? Come on,
exactly.
Where to watch, stream it on Tubi, buy a box set Blu-ray from Grove Entertainment. Got the Grove.
Just buy it.
Yeah, buy it. It's great. Watch it. anything else to add before we jump into our synopsis?
Oh yeah, just one thing on the print that we're able to see, and it was actually used in the Blu-ray restoration, is it was one of the lost fully complete reels of Critters, and it was discovered only after the writer passed away, and he had, you know, these reels in his closet, buried deep in his closet, and they were fully the theatrical run, the completed version, that with the ending that we're all kind of aware of. There was originally two different endings, but, you know, the reels he had were the reels that, like, ultimately that the movie was. And that was the print that has now resurfaced and was restored into 2K, which I think is really cool. So if you do get the Blu-ray, just know that it looks absolutely phenomenal. And it is the full theatrical cut as it was intended to see, which is really neat.
That's cool.
All right. Let's dive in. So originally I was going to keep track of, so they we see a prison asteroid, Sector 17, maximum security. It's coming in for a landing, and we learn that there's a ship that's bringing 10 Krites, but they had to kill two of them because they were eating everything. And originally I was going to keep track of how many Krites were remaining. I did not do that. So I do not know if they actually kill all 8 or not.
Well, as we'll find out later, that doesn't even matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Inside, we see this bald, like, alien sitting in a hover chair, Warden Zanti, and some other cool-looking, like, demon-looking aliens, maybe like a werewolf-looking guy, kind of. And they know the Krites are up to something. There's an explosion, and the Krites steal a ship and escape. Where are they going in this stolen ship? Earth.
Gotta say, I don't have much faith in the galactic government if this is a maximum security facility. I think, believe they escape in about 30 seconds.
they escape. Jeff, we gotta get this plot moving.
We don't even have our own guys. We have to hire bounty hunters to go after them.
Warden Zanti says to get the bounty hunters, which to get the bounty hunters implies that they're doing this all the time.
Yes. Oh boy, get the bounty hunters again.
We see the bounty hunters, and Matt, do you want to explain what the bounty hunters look like? Because I think they look cool as hell.
I do too.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. That aesthetic, you know, the two bounty hunters are introduced, and they're initially, you know, a blank face, which was kind of, you know, something that was not unusually, you know, shown in 80s cinema. And they were able to morph the faces, you know, depending on the conditions. And what we get a glimpse of is the bounty hunters kind of scanning what might be normal on planet Earth. So, you know, they go through this reel of footage. It's like a collage montage of footage. And the one bounty hunter gets fixated on like a faux MTV rock star, Johnny Steele, which is kind of a riff on Bon Jovi, and transmorphs into, you know, a Johnny Steele lookalike, which is a fantastic look. The whoever did the costume design for the bounty hunters did a bang up job. And then very humorously, the second bounty hunter just doesn't like whatever he's seeing on Earth and just rides it out with a blank face as long as possible, which brings up some other humorous moments throughout the film.
Johnny Steele, we get our second movie in a row with a hair metal music video as a big part of the film.
Yes. I mean, it's a pretty good song, but I don't know if it's in April.
You know, but yeah, it's no Killer Party April.
Great shape-shifting alien design, I gotta say.
Yeah, the glowing green face is so neat. Opening credits roll over shots of stars. We get our title card, and what a cool title card. You get like it very reminiscent of The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then also the T's on critters have like little crike claws at the bottom.
Yeah,
really neat. On Earth in Kansas, we see the Brown family farm. Helen is making breakfast. She calls Brad and April down, but Brad's hogging the bathroom, trying to raise the temperature of his thermometer. That's what the kids are calling it these days. she calls up Jay, who is concerned about his bowling shirt for the big tournament tonight. April talks to her boyfriend, Steve, on the phone, and then the kids go off to school. At the police station, Sally, played by Lynn Shea, is reading the National Enquirer and tells us and Sheriff Harv that Charlie's in the drunk tank. In the cell, Charlie talks about how they are coming, and he can hear it like in the fillings in his teeth. And then he thinks he's hearing alien communication again, but it's Jeff, a police officer, on the radio signing off for the day. Harv sends Charlie to work at Jay and Helen's farm.
Knew I shouldn't have got all those fillings done in the Philippines, Jay.
In space, the bounty hunters Lee and Ugg are going to use their shape-changing abilities, and this is where we see the Power of the Night music video.
Yes.
Where Ugg chooses Johnny Steele. Lee says like nothing fits him, but the transformation's so cool. Like his face melts away.
That skull effect, yeah.
And then then you see like the tissue and the blood like reappear. Oh, it was awesome. Such a neat transformation. Back in the farm, Brad is blowing things up with fireworks and distracting Charlie from doing his job.
Jay, hand me that carburetor. Jay?
Steve drops April off, and we learn Steve is staying for dinner tonight. Charlie hits April in the butt with a slingshot, and Brad takes the blame for it and is sent to his room, where he listens to Johnny Steele some more.
I just want to point out, Jay, that he may have a fancy car, this new boyfriend, but he's not going to be able to haul any hay with that thing.
He's a real New York dork.
Yep, that's what I've heard.
At dinner, the family aggressively eats corn on the cob, like aggressively so.
I mean, we're from Iowa, we know what it's like.
As April caresses Steve's thigh and then says, "Let's go, you promised me a ride." Jay just wants to make sure she'll be back for the big bowling tournament tonight. man, I really hope we get a resolution to this bowling tournament.
I also like
a big deal in town.
I also like that her boyfriend seems way more interested in going to see the bowling tournament than going to hang out with her.
April gets in Steve's car and drives it behind the barn, and then takes him inside to fuck. And in the hayloft, but Steve has allergies.
Don't worry, Jay. It'll be about 20 minutes later. They'll still be kissing fully clothed.
Charlie sees the Kreitz ship fly above. And while at the farm, the Kreitz like kind of crash land close by, causing an earthquake that Jay and Brad go to investigate. And we get the great line where April goes, "Oh, the ground moved," or the earth shook, and then Steve goes, "Oh, already?" Jay and Brad go, and they find a cow that the Kreitz have eaten part of. Officer Jeff sees a Kreitz roll by, and he swerves to avoid it, crashing his cruiser immediately. Oops. And then he like gets out. He's like, "Get over, come here, boy. Not thinking that this hairy thing rolling across the road was a dog of some kind. Come here, boy." And then gets dragged under his cruiser and eaten.
Don't forget, this is after, in true Jeff fashion, being hilariously shot down about a breakfast date.
My favorite thing is she says, "I'm doing my hair," or I'm washing my hair. Yeah. And then later on, we see that Lynn Sherry actually has hair curlers. She wasn't lying. She was actually washing her hair. Helen and Chewy the cat get spooked by some Kreitz arriving at the farm. Ugg and Lee land and also find the remains of the cow. Jay and Brad arrive back at the farm and try to call for help, but the Kreitz chew through the power cords. So Jay goes to investigate and gets attacked in the cellar. The Kreitz bites his shoulder, ooh, ruining his awesome bowling shirt, and then bites his leg and shoots him with one of their little poison quills that knock people out. Helen and Brad are able to haul Jay out of the cellar to safety.
Classic Jay move.
Getting bit,
yeah,
ruining your nice shirt. Yeah, these are things I do. Ugg and Lee find Jeff's cruiser, and Lee takes Jeff's form, but it's all like the cut up bloody version,
so he can only copy what he sees, apparently.
Yep. They then take the cruiser, unaware of how to drive it, so they start driving down the road in reverse.
Yes.
Which
it's little details like that that really sell it.
Every moment with Ugg and Lee in the car is some of my favorite stuff in the whole movie.
Let's see. Now there's an angle for a Critters spinoff. Let's just have them going around doing their job as bounty hunters. See what else they get up to.
Back in the fuck barn, the Kreitz bite off Steve's fingers and then chew a hole through his chest as April screams. Brad, the family hears her screaming, and Brad finds her and tosses a firework at the Kreitz, who eats it, and then it explodes in his mouth, and we get this cool little effect of him like burping as smoke comes out, and then he just keels over dead. Charlie arrives at the police station telling Sally to call Harv and
the army.
And
I don't know if the army wouldn't come for a leprechaun. I don't know if they're going to come for some.
I don't think they're going to come for Kreitz either. At a church, a priest is going to give a sermon about Sodom and Gomorrah and like the how terrible the town is. And then there's a large commotion outside and people are screaming. And then in comes Ugg and Lee, who just drive through the front of the church, shoot it up. Lee takes the form of the pastor, and then they just leave and drive off again.
This had Clancy Brown in Highlander energy to me when he goes into the church.
Oh, also, this is where they say their famous line. Matt, what's that famous line they say when they show up at the church?
"We're here for the Kreitz."
Oh, that's the thing.
He said the thing.
The family attempts to leave the farmhouse, locking the door behind them. But when they get to the truck, they find that it's been chewed up by critters.
Oh, boy.
And April goes, "Don't worry, I've got Steve's keys." So they go to Steve's car parked behind the barn, and they get inside, and there's a giant critter inside who chases them back to the house.
They're growing.
Helen fights a couple of them off, and Brad climbs a tree to get into the house and then gets the family inside.
It's another Gremlins similarity. Badass moms who kill one of the enemies.
Yep. I'll get to it later. This is my favorite Dee Wallace performance, I think, maybe ever. Like, she's so great in this. At the bowling alley, the rest of Jay's team, the Pinbusters, can't reach him on the phone because the phone line is cut. Charlie is drunk telling everyone about the UFO he saw when the bounty hunters show up, ripping the front door off of its hinges, kind of like that Tim Robinson sketch where he's like, no, the door goes both ways, and then he breaks it. I think Ugg then picks up a bowling ball and just chucks it one-handed down the lane, shattering the pins when it hits it.
Oh, whose team is he on?
They then go into the bar where Lee takes Charlie's face, and then they fire their gun and cause a bunch of panic and blow up parts of the bowling alley and shit.
Excellent.
Sally calls Harv, finally waking him up.
Yeah, Sheriff's really on it.
Doesn't believe it when Charlie comes and says it, but when other people in town start complaining, all of a sudden, oh, now I gotta call Harv. And that's where we see Sally with all the curlers in her hair. At the farm, Brad is worried about his dad, and Dee Wallace has maybe her greatest line reading ever when she's like, Brad, go check the locks on the door. And he's like, I already did it. And she goes,
we'll check them again.
Which is great. It's fucking awesome. The Kreitz get into the house, and they are able to hit Helen with one of the quills. The whole family runs upstairs, and Brad grabs the shotgun, trips, shoots the ceiling fan, which falls and crushes a Krait.
Yes.
That was just like in the middle of the room. Brad throws a kerosene lamp, lighting another Krait on fire, and it rolls and jumps in the toilet where it extinguishes itself. Hope we don't get a real ghoulie situation and one of these guys gets them in the end. Harv goes to the church and then goes to the bowling alley. Brad convinces his dad that he can go for help, and he is almost to his bike when he sees the giant Krait and runs from it and kind of lures it towards the chicken coop. and then Brad sees that it's getting bigger as it's eating, and I'm sure nothing terrible happens in that chicken coop later on.
No.
We get a quick montage of the Krait's destroying Brad's room, including a Krait asking an ET plushie who he is and then eating it, which I thought was very funny.
I like that. Yes.
Brad runs into the bounty hunters and is confused when one of them is Charlie and the other one is Johnny Steele, but eventually agrees that they'll all work together to find the Kreitz. The Kreitz attack the room that the rest of the family is in, and Jay uses a makeshift flamethrower with hairspray, and Helen is able to shoot one of them with the shotgun through the door, but that's the last bullets.
Oh, no.
The Browns are about to make one last stand when the front door is blown off and the bounty hunters show up. The family runs out into the yard just as Harvey's showing up. Everyone showed up just at the right time. Putting the family in the back of his cruiser, Brad goes with Ugg and Lee to get Chewy the cat. Lee throws Harv through a window because they don't want him taking over their operation.
He asked him to put him down, and he did. I don't get what you're so upset about.
Brad finds Chewy, but runs into the giant Krait, but Ugg chases him off. Brad rides off because one of the Kreitz has shot April and has stolen her away. And as he's riding his bike, he runs into Charlie, who's also riding his bike in the opposite direction. And then the whole family is following along in the police cruiser, they're all ready to go, and Ugg and Lee get in theirs and realize it won't start. So they just walk over. One of them goes in the passenger side, and then the other one like kind of pushes Harv aside and gets in the driver's seat.
You're leaving out a crucial detail as they're just completely destroying this family home and fighting these Kreitz. One tries to hide in the toilet, Jay, and then he hilariously gets splashed with toilet shards and toilet water.
Yeah.
And he blows it apart with his gun.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that the one got destroyed in the toilet. Brad follows the Krites into their ship and is able to rescue April, and he's going to light one of his fireworks on fire, but the big Krite shows up and scares him, and he drops it, but he's able to escape, and as the ship is taking off, Charlie makes a Molotov cocktail and tosses it into the ship as it flies away. And the Krites, being the biggest dicks in the universe, stop above the family home, blowing it up with their lasers. And then they all laugh because they're like, ha-ha, we blew up your house. And then one of them realizes that the ship's on fire. And they go, uh-oh. And then the spaceship explodes. The bounty hunters leave, but first they give Brad some kind of space walkie-talkie to call them on.
He says, he actually thanks them. That's why he gets it.
They all go back to the farmhouse, and the thing Brad got starts beeping, and it rebuilds the house, and the bounty hunters do a little flyby, and everything is happy. But then we cut to the chicken coop, where we see three weird brown splotched eggs, and then they start making Krite noises.
Oh, no.
Credits roll, end of movie. I'm sure there's not a Critters 2, so yeah. This is just the end of it.
And we never heard from the Krites again.
Did I miss anything?
Oh, so many things.
All right. Well, how about we start off here? Let's do our Easter hymn, our favorite quotes. Whoa, whoa, I'm vamping. Whoa, whoa. Jay, who is Steve? Brad, the dork from New York. Got him.
So this is Charlie has apparently been bothering the bartender for a good solid half hour at least. He offers him another drink. He declines and he says, "All right, Charlie, I'm just going to leave the bottle. Don't bother anyone."
Morning, Sal. What's happening? This is Harv. And then Sal goes, "Well, this here says John Travolta used to be a waitress in Fort Myers, Florida." Harv, "What's happening here, Sal?" Sal, "Big bowling tournament tonight." Real question, who won the bowling tournament?
That's what I mean.
Matt, do we get a resolution to that in later Critters movies?
Sadly, no.
You know, if Jay had been there, they probably would have won.
Yes, I'm sure. So this is a Krite conversation I found pretty funny. So Critter number one, they have weapons. Critter number two, so what? He gets shot right off the porch. Fuck.
I also have that one. Harv, when like everything's going crazy, this town's a zoo.
The critters, as they crash land and their ship is like mostly destroyed. And he's like, "Status report." And the other one's like, "Minor damage."
The last one I have, that when the Krites land nearby and it causes like kind of tremors. April, "The earth moved." Steve, "Oh, already?" Fucking Steve. That's my last one. Matt, do you have any favorite quotes?
Oh, the one I thought was really funny in hindsight is when Jay is realizing that the phone is dead and he is repeatedly pushing the receiver, and he looks up dramatically and he just simply says, "This phone is dead."
Yes.
And apparently Brian Muir, who wrote the screenplay, was on set that day, and when he watched Billy Greenbush deliver that line, he had to cup his mouth to prevent himself from cracking up and blowing the take because he found it so funny. And I have to agree, it's really funny. I mean, the whole film is really loaded with great zingers. Even at the bowling alley, as the pins explode and it cuts to that younger bowler who just says, "Holy shit," yeah, was Billy Greenbush's son.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is even better, right? A little cameo in there, and he has that hilarious line. It's just... the whole thing is just crammed with absolutely hilarious lines and deliveries.
Like I said, the D. Wallace, "We'll check it again." It was like that's the greatest line delivery of all time.
It's very true to life for a mom in a stressful situation too. I had two more that I had from when their ship first crash lands. So Brad says, "Did you see that meteor?" And Jay says, "I saw something." And so Brad's like, "Maybe it's a Russian spy probe on some sort of secret mission." And Jay's like, "You watch too much TV."
My dad would have said that to me.
And then, of course, when they get to where the cow has been slaughtered around the crash site, Jay's like, "Smells like burning oil." Brad says, "Smells like cow crap to me, Dad." Is it Ugg or Lee that morphs into Charlie?
Charlie is Lee.
Okay. Yeah, because after he morphs into him or whatever, he turns around to the other guy and he's like, "Keep your shirt on, asshole."
Let's do Sunday best, sets, costumes, etc. Right off the bat,
where do we even start?
I fucking love the Pinbusters fucking bowling shirts. If Fright Rags or whoever ever made like ones to wear, like I would be first in line for a Pinbuster shirt that says Jay on the front, because that's literally my name. I would wear that fucker all the time. Fright Rags, I know you don't listen, but if you do, get on it. I think all the aliens look really cool.
The costuming is great.
Ugg and Lee, awesome look. I love like the leather trench coats, the leather suits like that they're wearing. I love the weird green faces. Like, I think they look awesome. I love the warden and his bald head in his floating chair, like all sorts of cool shit.
And we already talked some about it, but the effects work is insane. Like that transformation scene when he first becomes Johnny Steele, that was crazy.
All sorts of great explosions, all sorts of great effects, and shit blowing up. And
every time the bounty hunters use their guns, those effects. I love how everything just explodes.
Like around. Half a wall just missing in the Brown family house. I want to shout out, Brad had a poster for the police in his bedroom. So even though he's clearly a big Johnny Steele fan, because everyone's fucking talking about Johnny Steele, I do want to, like, I mean, Brad does have some taste. I mean, he likes the police. They're pretty good. I like Roxanne. That's a solid song.
That's a song. Yeah, yeah.
I
mean, the sets were pretty cool. I like the family house. It's cool, especially when they're like fighting through it at the end. I thought that was really well shot.
Do you think, Jeff, do you think this is the same house they used for Leprechaun? Look pretty similar.
It does look very similar. I was going to point that out. I'm like, is this the Leprechaun house again?
It'd be wild if it was.
But no, yeah, I definitely picked up on that. The exterior shots too, like that big barn and stuff, reminded me of where the Leprechaun goes to build his death machine.
Matt, do you have anything we haven't shouted out or anything you want to shout out?
No, I definitely agree about the bounty hunters' outfits. You know, the costume work that they did there was phenomenal. But even the look of Johnny Steele, like, you know what really makes it critical? I was talking about the look that Terrence Mann went with for the first one. Unfortunately, does not really bring it to the second one. But his hair in the first one's a wig. And, man, is that like an icon? Like, that looks... It's so memorable. It looks so great. And it just conjures up so much about what big band, you know, big hair band musicians look like at that particular time. It was just a great, great look. And then to have that kind of transitioned into the bounty hunter, I thought was incredibly cool. And like you said, the Pinbuster shirt, I mean, what a masterpiece. How cool is that? You know, the riff on Ghostbusters with the pin on the back. Just incredibly cool. And just one quick comment on Bradley Brown's character. You know, he's kind of in this nondescript blank t-shirt most of the film. Because Scott Grimes was so small at the time, he didn't weigh very much. You know, he was kind of, even himself, very nondescript. They had to put wiring in the t-shirt to broaden out his shoulders. So in a couple of the sequences, you can really see just how wide and broad his shoulders are.
I can't relate to this at all.
So I thought that was a nice touch too. And of course, Nadine's character, April with her farmer's daughter's look. I thought she just pulled it off great.
I didn't write it down. Doesn't Steve's license plate say something like one cool dude or something like
yep.
that? Like,
yep. Yeah. And what's incredible too is you know, speaking of the house and also speaking of the budget, right? You know, less than $5 million. And what they did was they got this kind of sparsely populated, if not unpopulated, tract of farmland up in Valencia. And they built the entire house and barn for the shoot.
Wow.
They didn't seek a rental or a location that existed. They just built all that stuff. And so when, you know, so many of the folks that were involved with the film were speaking of this and how low budget it was, it's like, well, yeah, there's low budget and then there's micro budget. I mean, you guys had an all right budget in my opinion. You're able to build the house that you could blow the walls apart. Yeah. Ultimately, you know, they detonate it for the crate ship blast at the very end. You know, and they blew it up with explosives that was left over from a James Bond movie. So,
that's,
you know,
awesome.
It really, really cool stuff. I know they always kind of tout how low budget it was, but there's also, you know, some very happy accidents with what they were able to pull off, especially with the, in my opinion, with the costumes and the set construction.
Well, I mean, inventing that machine that obviously stores snapshots of time to rebuild structures, that must have been really taxing on them.
No, like you could say low budget, but like I think for $3 million today, you aren't getting all the explosions and all of the and building a whole house and shit.
Like, that seems like a fairly respectable mid-80s like creature feature budget.
Yeah, you know, the thing that always bothers me too, right, is there are several sequences with the spaceship that we get to see, and some of the stuff is fairly up close as well. They built the entire spaceship facade out of plywood. And, you know, you can imagine how much it would cost, even if we did a short film today, you know, what it would cost to build the equivalent spaceship out of plywood. You know, you're talking thousands of dollars, even if you got used or kind of crappy, you know, leftover wood. Mm-hmm. You're still talking about a nice chunk of money. And that was just kind of like one of the many things they had sprinkled throughout the film. That I thought they really pulled it off. The dead cow, you know, for its quick, you know, couple sequences was built primarily out of a steer skull and a bunch of leftover special makeup effects equipment, including paper towels and newspapers. And it looks awesome, you know.
No, it looks really good.
You know, but you make a great point. It's like, you know, you try to do this stuff today and there's no way that you're getting off with, you know, a couple, you know, $3 million today. I don't think it would look nearly as good as it did back then. And with how many people they had working on this.
All right, we've seen what, I mean, I'm sure you've seen too, what Mike's been doing with the, just remaking one room from scratch or whatever. Yes, he's doing for dead format.
Yeah.
No, it's a great, great point. And I think about it as I watch him kind of, you know, build. It looks awesome. But I could just imagine, you know, just what goes into the cost estimates and kind of space and the, you know, renting the space to even get enough room to shoot, you know, within a couple interiors. Whereas these guys built really an entire family farmhouse and made it look good. Like all of it looked completely convincing. They even had the added touch of the windmill, which is kind of an icon of the film. And that was, I mean, today, who would, you know, spend the extra, at this point, probably $5,000 on a windmill just for a couple B-roll shots? I just can't see it happening, you know.
You'd be getting off lucky for $5,000. As a man who's recently redone the flooring in his house, I had no idea how expensive wood is, especially I can't imagine building a windmill.
Let's do Easter Spirit. How Eastery is this movie and how Eastery are the kills?
Oh, it's very Eastery. I mean, there's eggs, chicken, and crate.
I was going to say, This movie, not especially Easter-y, except that there are little guys running around doing stuff. And that's kind of what the Easter Bunny is a little guy running around doing stuff. Critters 2, however, will be very Easter-y, or slightly Easter-y.
No, that's a great point. They probably had a missed opportunity to fuse a holiday around this particular setting. And I think Easter would have worked just fine.
What if they had done something weird like
Arbor Day?
No. Flag Day. And then Critters 2 takes place days later, but now it's suddenly Easter. No other beloved franchise has done a St. Patrick's Day to Christmas or anything like that.
Jay, you're sounding like a maniac.
Some kind of maniac cop. And then the third movie where there's just the greatest chase scene of all time.
Yes.
Matt, the maniac cop's on fire, pushing cars out of the way with his bare hands.
Oh, I'd love it.
Continuously on fire on screen for a solid 10 minutes.
Absolutely love it.
Oh, what a movie. All right, let's do Rotten Egg and Chocolate Egg. One thing you would like to fix, one thing you would like to praise. Matt, you can go first. What's one thing you want to fix for this movie and one thing you really want to shout out for this movie that we haven't already shouted out? Or it could be something we've already shouted out.
I think one thing I would fix would probably be, and I know, you know, going back to the making of it, there was this kind of dispute within the vision of just how violent to go with it and things like that. But, you know, for the little violence that is actually captured, I think that it would have suited them well just to just play it out a little bit further. The scene where Jay is in the basement and he's kind of attacking the Krites in the first encounter with the hammer was way more violent than the version that we saw. I think it would have made sense to just kind of play that out to its maximum, have him, you know, see what it looks like to kill one of these things. And the fact that they can be killed would have been helpful at that stage of the film. For the Billy Zane death scene, as cool as it would have been to see the critters burrowing into his chest cavity, you'll notice when he does get his fingers bit off, there's a jump cut in there because the ratings board was like, no, we can't have the full fingers being devoured by the critter. So if you watch it, you'll actually see the quick, you know, I think there's three frames that they had to cut out. And it just is, it's kind of this bizarre little blip that looks like a qualitative issue rather than them like purposely cutting it out. I think some tweaks like that would have gone a long way. But the things that I really enjoyed, you know, that I think really hit the mark was the fact that they all played their roles so straight. And by doing so, you know, taking the material so seriously, I think amplified the humor to a lot of the stuff, the jokes that were supposed to be funny, as well as the stuff like we mentioned that might not meant, you know, it shouldn't have been like on the nose, but it was still funny as hell. And we're still laughing about it 40 years later. I think was just excellent. You know, that kind of atmosphere that they were able to capture, which I think is really hard to do without going too kind of corny or too, you know, self-aware, it's, in my opinion, really hard to do.
We always, I think I'm speaking for Jeff and I both, we always love when like a movie plays its comedy straight. Like as much as we do kind of, yeah, we'll laugh at kind of silly things. Like when a movie is doing something silly, but they are playing it straight, like it just makes it so much better.
It's only so much winking at the camera you can take. It's much better when people commit to the treating the movie as a real place, a real universe to live in.
The only movie that's maybe the exception is Two Front Teeth. Yeah. That's the only movie where I'm okay with be as goofy as you want. Who gives a shit?
Yep. No, I absolutely agree with you guys.
Jeff, Rotten Egg, thing you want to fix?
Honestly, the only thing I could think about to fix, because I mean, yes, I did notice that there's an odd lack of family members dying in this. I'm like, really? Everybody's going to make it to the end? I mean, the boyfriend dies, but who cares?
Yeah, who gives a shit about Steve?
And poor Jeff.
I mean, poor Jeff.
He's out there somewhere.
Wait, I'm Jeff.
Don't worry, he's going to go on to be on Star Trek, so it'll be fine.
Steve's going to go on to be in Titanic.
That's true.
And more importantly, the Phantom Slam Evil.
But I honestly wanted a little bit more time with the Krites, I think. Maybe a little bit more, like, either some more exposition from the warden, or maybe the bounty hunters, like, look up a file or something. Just a little, knowing a little bit more about them, I think. And maybe, like, you know, they could have pulled up something to raise the stakes a little bit, since they were kind of limited on the violence. Be like, show some, like, shots of, like, a planet on fire or whatever. Be like, and this is the last planet the Krites were at or whatever. Something like that, you know, to kind of set the stakes for the audience.
And chocolate egg, thing you want to praise.
Ugg and Lee, those two guys, even though they're in an objectively ridiculous role as alien bounty hunters in leather trench coats with pipe
giant guns,
with pipe shaped cannons that they're carrying around, they play it so well. You do buy them as genuine, especially like the bar scene and the church scene. You do buy them as like actual menacing threats. And the way that they speak, honestly, I think the only thing that I would say is a better or maybe on par thing is the way that Arnold talks as the Terminator.
Ooh, that's a good point.
They do seem very alien when they talk, which is a hard thing to pull off. Usually, you know, once you got a shape-shifting alien in a movie, it's like, okay, so we have a guy in a mask for about 2 seconds, and then he's just going to act like a normal guy. They actually act like alien bounty hunters. Like, I love the car detail that you talked about earlier, where they don't know how a car works. Because, you know, in a movie today, they just jump in the car and know how to drive it.
Yep. Like, there might be something about, like, they saw one person driving, so now they understand
how to drive a car. Now we know how cars work. I also like the limitations they put on them. Like, Ugg was not able to copy a healthy Jeff. He copied the wounded, dead Jeff. So he had like the leaking neck wound
that,
stuff,
yeah, that was
freaking
so cool.
Everybody out in the church. And the way that their faces pulsed and their eyes glowed when they were changing forms, I thought that was a really cool effect. But yeah, the way that they played their role completely straight and seemed genuinely menacing, I was impressed with, because it would have been very easy for them to just be like a comedy relief duo, especially in a movie like this.
For my rotten egg, kind of what you were saying, Jeff, I think a good place for this, I would have liked more cool aliens, 5-10 minutes more of cool aliens. I love seeing cool, weird looking alien costumes and shit like that. And I think, you know, you could have had them, you know, like you said, you could have seen like a planet of aliens that the Krites had devoured, or like you could have seen the aliens that were bringing the Krites to the prison asteroid or whatever. Like, you could have seen like something like that, I think would have been kind of neat.
Maybe seeing them hijack the ship instead of just hearing it over the radio.
Yep. Yeah, a little more show don't tell. My chocolate egg, the thing I want to praise, this is my favorite D. Wallace performance. I'm not a huge E.T. fan. I had Red Christmas fucking sucks. You know, Cujo's solid, but like I think Dee Wallace is badass in this movie. I think she's really fucking cool. Blows two critters away with a shotgun and punts another one across the yard with the butt of the shotgun. I think this is the best she looks. Dee Wallace really, everything I've ever seen her in, short kind of bob cut or something like that, she has really long hair. I think she looks better than she's looked in other movies. I was sitting there and I was just like, this is my favorite Dee Wallace thing. Like, I might be controversial, but I loved her in this. I thought she was so great. Yeah. More long-haired Dee Wallace. That's what I'm saying. Final rating. Every episode of Horror for the Holiday. What's the name of our podcast again? Every episode of Horror for the Holidays, we rate our podcast. We'll try this again.
This is staying in, folks.
Every episode of Horror for the Holidays, we rate our movie on one of three categories. This, because it's Easter, we are rating this on Hop Hop Hoplarious.
Yes.
Bad Friday.
Ooh.
There's an Easter pun for you. And It Has Risen. The movie itself has risen.
Yes, okay.
There you go. Good. All right.
Thank you for specifying.
Matt, what do you want to rate Critter?
Okay. So if It Has Risen is, you know, we'll say
it's Jesus. It's Jesus coming back from the dead.
I think, you know, in context of it being 40 years old and the fact that, you know, we're celebrating it this Easter season, this many decades later, I think, you know, it speaks to its presence and kind of importance in the horror sci-fi genre. Definitely dings some points for not fully amplifying the Easter holiday, you know, into the film itself. But, you know, overall, qualitatively, and what it means from a historical perspective, that's where I would kind of place this one.
Jeff?
I also, well, I didn't know the category before Jay just read them out, but yes, it has risen indeed. Critters is here to save us. I mean,
they died for our sins.
How could you not? Yes, I'm loving this foray into blasphemous podcasting, Jay. Thank you. No, how can you not like Critters? I mean, if you watch Critters and you don't like it, what's wrong with you, Jay? And I think we're going to have some people weighing in on that in a minute.
We will, yeah. But,
I mean, cool effects, cool characters. I mean, it's a straightforward story. It's nothing that's going to like blow your mind, but it's fun. Unlike a lot of these movies that we watch, this one pretty much flew by. I was not, you know, checking the runtime.
Quick watch.
Yes. It's like, you know, some of these movies you check, it's like, oh my God, it's only been 10 more minutes. But yeah, this one, no problem watching or rewatching. This was my first time ever actually watching it, and I gotta say, I'm gonna be watching it again for sure.
I went hop, 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 hilarious. This movie's incredibly silly, has awesome monsters, great effects. And it's, and like you said, an absolute breeze. It flies by, and so often we've watched trash that just takes forever to get through. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, like, maybe between like minute 10 and 20, it's a little slow, but as soon as it hits nighttime and it's the family dinner, the movie just speeds along, and you're like, you know, I paused at one point and I'm like, wait, there's only like 10 minutes left. Like, there's still so much that has to happen. It's nuts. This movie's awesome. Like, just a great time. But Jeff, we stepped in dog poop during the Easter egg hunt.
Uh-oh, Grandma brought over a bunch of Easter grass for the kids. What are we going to do now?
reviews that are different than the way we felt about the movie. I got two. I didn't want to do too many when we've got a guest on the podcast. 1 out of 10. Oh my God. My son asked me to sit through this truly awful film, and I wish I hadn't. Acting, production value, script were so disturbing, I had to shower after the film had finished to cleanse myself. Jeff, was this your dad?
Might have been.
This B-movie garbage has been described by some as a cult classic. Some even have the audacity to describe this film as a comedy horror. I mean,
audacity.
That's exactly what it is. Sadly for those mindless individuals, okay, I guess we're mindless, the movie has nothing to recommend itself for. It astonishes me, however, that somehow almost all of the cast seem to evaporate into the ether after making this masterpiece. Literally, Scott Grimes is constantly getting work. What the fuck are you talking about? Critters should have a government health warning on it and has to be avoided at all costs. Utter garbage.
A government health warning, huh? I think we might be dealing with a monarchist in our midst, Jay.
government health warning. Nothing says people don't watch this movie if the government comes out and says, don't watch this. if time has proven anything, telling people not to do a thing certainly doesn't lead to more people doing
it. Jay, famously, no one watched the video nasties.
You're right. That's why we don't know about all those movies. You got one?
0 stars, if I could. Hell's one, yeah. Star, because they made me.
Hells yeah.
Gotta love these review titles. Let's get one thing out of the way. Critters is not a hidden gem. It is not misunderstood. It is not so bad it's good.
I think it's all those things.
This is what happens when a studio sees some dollar signs in their eyes and says, what if we made, like, I don't know, a worse version of the average movie? From the opening scene, the film establishes a level of cheapness that borders on parody. What? If there's anything you could say about Critters, the opening is awesome.
Yeah, right.
Does not look cheap at all.
It's Star Wars level.
The intergalactic prison, in quotation marks, of course, looks less like a cosmic facility and more like a repurposed basement with Christmas lights. Are we watching the same movie? I don't know.
Jeff, probably. Sometimes I do wonder. Like, are they watching the Shudder original three-part miniseries of Critters? I don't know.
The creatures escape with all the tension of a group of hamsters slipping out of a cardboard box. And then we meet the stars of the show, the Critters themselves. These are supposedly terrifying alien predators, but resemble angry pom-poms with dental problems. Their big gimmick, rolling. Oh yeah, they really play that up, Jay. That's their whole thing.
Yep.
Rolling. They love rolling around. That's right, they roll. Not in a terrifying, unstoppable force way, more like a set of defective Roombas that occasionally bite extras. They bite one of the main actors in the film, by the way.
And launch the little things at the other two. Like,
this film desperately wants you to take them seriously, but the effect is closer to mild irritation. It's hard to feel dread when your villain looks like it could be defeated by a well-placed laundry basket. Human characters don't help. The Brown family is so generic, they feel like placeholders waiting for real characters to arrive. Dialogue consists of mostly, "What was that? Did you hear something? Oh my God." It doesn't, but whatever.
No, sure doesn't.
That's very memorable lines in this movie, yet again. It's not clever. It's not funny. It's baffling. Maybe next time, pick a tone. This bargain bin creature feature proves how... That proves not every 80s horror flick deserves a nostalgic second look. Maybe leave this one on the shelf.
Don't. In fact, write a whole book about it.
Yeah. We are, in fact, here for the credits.
All right, I got one more. 3 out of 10. Fuzzy Wuzzy kids movie. Hey, with cute fuzzy wuzzies running around with teeth, what better way to give a kid nightmares, right? Just a precious, obnoxious 12 or 13 year old who's smarter than the parents who are pretty stupid in Hollywood. Didn't you know that? Or a dad, Billy Green.
Pause for a second. The parents are not stupid.
No, they're not at all.
In fact, the dad is one of the smarter dads in horror movies because he's like, okay, we can't stay here. Obviously, they're intelligent. They cut the power. They cut the phone line. Hiding in the house isn't going to do anything. That's actually a smart thing to think.
The cops are stupid. Well, they're always stupid, but
well, I mean, one of the cops is stupid. The sheriff was, you know, sleeping off his bender and got rudely awakened in the middle of the night, Jay. He does get out to the farmhouse though once he figures out what's going on.
Or a dad, Billy Green Bush, who acts more like the kid's best friend than his dad. No, he literally grounds him.
Yeah, I was going to say he punishes him and tries to send him to bed with no dinner.
Or a mom, Dee Wallace, who's pretty helpless at everything except cooking. She literally shoots two of them, one of them no-scoping through a door. Like, or a daughter who can't keep her hormones in check with her airhead boyfriend. I mean, okay, yeah, that tracks. Yeah. And there you have it, the perfect Hollywood family. And God, are they dumb. The fuzzy wuzzies look so precious that you just want to take one home with you. I do, anyway. It might keep the cat away. Ha, ha, ha.
We got a comedian on our hands.
And the alien bounty hunters that are sent after the escaped furballs are even dumber than the farm family. They're aliens. Like, they're playing aliens. It's a wonder that they're able to go into outer space, let alone drive a car. Isn't there a film called Morons from Outer Space? They'd be good in that one.
Are they really dumb? I mean... For two guys who just landed on a planet they've never been to, they find what they're looking for in about 40 minutes.
Yeah. Some cool reverse action photography involving the reconstruction of the farmhouse at the end looked pretty good, but that's all I can really say positive about it. There's no gore. This is a PG-13 film. I mean, there is some gore. So don't look for too many adult themes in this one. However, I can't really see parents taking their little kids to see it either. And teenagers would just be too jaded and sophisticated for it. So I don't know who the viewing audience would be besides me. They gave this 3 out of 10. I don't know who the viewing audience would be except for me. The New Light DVD has no extras in it beyond trailers for the endless sequels that Hollywood horror masturbates over. I suspect they're more boring than this one, with M. Emmett Walsh as the dumb sheriff and Billy Zane as the airhead boyfriend. That's just added at the end in a paragraph by itself, and then it's at the end of the review. So I don't fucking...
I don't know if you could really say endless sequels. I know several franchises with way more entries than this one.
Yes, there are. There are five movies.
I would rather fist fight one of these things than watch this again. I finally watched Critters because people keep whispering about it like it's some lost 80s gem. Let me save you the time. This movie is what happens when a studio tries to make a movie but forgets to include talent, charm, or basic competence. People try to hype these things up like they're terrifying. Do they?
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of lists of movie monsters. The Critters have never made it anywhere close to the top.
I mean, by the logic that there are people out there that are afraid of the leprechaun,
yeah,
I'm sure there is someone out there who saw Critters on like Sci-Fi Channel late at night one night when they were seven and think Critters are the scariest thing ever.
Well, yeah, let's slow down here, Jay. Does the leprechaun have his gold or not?
What's up, Matt?
I've heard many, you know, it's very interesting that you bring that up. I encountered many viewers, probably 70% female viewers, 30% male, that said, you know, when they had first watched it, that it stuck with them. And, it, this idea of a porcupine-sized, you know, rolling ball terrified them. And, a couple of them had bad encounters with violent dogs and stuff like that, so it kind of makes sense to me.
But I can see that.
You know, there's definitely a lot of feedback that I had even heard just traveling around that people said, I watched it one time, scared me, I'll never watch it again. So I think there is something to it.
No, not according to this guy, Matt. These are just the lamest things ever. Nothing. I love how, especially because I tend to pull reviews from Reddit. And so on Reddit, anything you've most recently seen is the worst thing you've ever seen.
It's either the greatest movie ever made or it's the worst thing you've ever seen. And there's no in between.
Yes. They're like angry little hamsters that just discovered cocaine. Their whole move is roll, bite, squeak. That's it. They also speak, but whatever.
Yeah.
And could I beat
one of these with a folding chair? Yes. Could I beat two of these? Maybe.
What an odd number to stop.
I like how he's not even... He's saying his chances are worse than D. Wallace's, apparently, beating these things. Let's talk about the pacing. 86 minutes is way too long for this garbage.
No, it's the perfect. It's the perfect amount.
Nothing happens. I mean, lots of things happen. If you had to say something about the movie Critters, it could be things happen because that's pretty much what happens the entire movie.
Lots of stuff happens.
And I got to say, the characters, I've seen more personality in an Amazon box.
Oh,
got some real zingers in here. Nobody reacts like a real human being. Your farm is under attack by alien murder fuzzballs, and your first response is run. That seems odd. No.
I would do too. But
I mean, we're dealing with... So this guy says they're pussies, apparently, for not staying and fighting for their farm, Jay, but also he acknowledges he probably couldn't take on two critters.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah.
And the bounty hunters, who approved this? These guys walk in like they're from a completely different movie. Huh, maybe they're supposed to be aliens.
Right?
I don't know. It looked like they spliced in some footage from a rejected sci-fi TV movie pilot. And then one of them turns into a rock star. No buildup, no logic, no reason.
There didn't need to be. Bonnie Steele's not a real rock star. This isn't a white sister situation.
That's true. Have you heard of, you've heard of big hair bands, Matt, so surely you've heard of white sister. You say that then on their website that Jay went to, they say that they're one of the big four.
One of the big Hollywood hair bands. Let me pull it up. And listeners have already heard this, but we're going to do it again because it's too good.
It's just that good.
All right, hold on. during the heyday of the early 80s hair metal, there was a core group of bands that would rise together from the streets of Hollywood. And Matt, I'm sure you've heard of all of these. Sam with me, Motley Crue, Rat, and Great White. You are already familiar with. But there was another popular member of that group. That band was White Sister.
The big four.
The famous fourth one that we've all heard. Yeah.
That's so good.
Oh, I'll just wrap up here for this. This isn't so bad, it's good. This is so bad, it makes you question your life choices. At least a bad movie would be interesting, but this is just boring. Critters is so aggressively mediocre, it's exhausting.
Oh, man.
I'm glad we were able to hear from this guy, Jay.
God.
Matt, do you have in your researching for the book, did you discover any great reviews from maybe even more iconic sources than people on Reddit or IMDb?
Well, you know what's interesting? You know, around the time it came out, generally speaking, it fared very favorably among critics. You know, famously, it was praised by Siskel and Ebert and a bunch of other, you know, especially some of the big New York critics also enjoyed. But, you know, over time, the one thing that I see both in person and, you know, in written reviews, you know, like this one here, it says, it took everything I had in me not to fall asleep before the critters arrived. And the other one is, you know,
it's like 10-20 minutes. It's not that long.
I mean, they're in the
I totally agree. And it's like this movie is fine, but it's way too slow, spelled T-O, not T-O-O-O. You know, and it's like the thing that I think is lost is the inspiration for, you know, Critters came from a lot of the earlier 50s and 60s sci-fi monster movies, with the catch being that what was not really around at the time was smaller monsters, smaller creatures. It was a lot of larger monsters. But this movie is really a direct riff on Invaders from Mars, 1953. And when you watch that, you know, Bradley Brown's character is pretty much the child protagonist in that film. The farmhouse looks the same. The picket fence is the same. He watches as the UFO kind of crashes in the distance, mistakes it for either an asteroid or a, you know, Russian satellite or something. And even the aliens in it, kind of some big butthead aliens that are similar to Warden Zonti appear in that film. And, you know, obviously Brian Muir was kind of playing with that notion. Of course, he was very inspired by the Zonti Misfits episode of The Outer Limits. And he plays, you know, some homage to that too, which I thought was great. And, you know, you also get a lot of critics and critique that it ripped off of Gremlins, which is not true at all, since, you know, Brian wrote it in the late 70s and Christopher, you know, Columbus wrote Gremlins in the early 80s, like 83, not too far before, you know, he sold the screenplay and stuff. So, you know, you just get into this realm of viewers from the last 20, you know, years or so that discover it for the first time. And really just kind of missed the point of not only the film itself, but how and when it was made and why it was made. And I think we're better off with it. And I definitely don't agree that it's way too slow. Like you guys said, it kicks off with the critters, you know, right off the bat. And a lot of the stuff you pointed out, right? Like, hey, it would have been great to see more alien monsters in this. That was really written in the original script. There was an extra like about 10 minutes of those scenes on the asteroid. We got to see a little bit more about Warden Zonti, and there was a co-warden that was a slightly different alien,
man.
And there was different guards that were keeping the Krites like in the cells that were actually designed and built. They didn't film them, but they built the monsters, which was really cool. And you can kind of see that they tried to do that in the beginning of the sequel, but all of that stuff was originally written for the first one. and was ultimately cut just because of budgetary and scheduling issues. But some of the guys that made those prosthetic effects were none too pleased to see that their work, you know, was for naught as those scenes were canceled. But, you know, overall, I don't see any issue with the pacing whatsoever. I think it kind of did its work to conjure up this idealized, you know, the whole theme was Americana. You know, the producers that were in charge of funding this said, you know, Americana was really, you know, one of the producers was British, actually. So for him, you know, getting this notion of what, you know, American ideals was really important. And I think they did a fantastic job. And I totally agree that this is probably one of Dee Wallace's most iconic portrayals of a female matriarch in her horror catalog that she has to offer. She has some great films under her belt, but, you know, Helen Brown, the character, was probably perfectly played by her. And I think the chemistry with, you know, Billy Greenbush as Jay Brown was damn near perfect for a rural American family, nuclear family in the early 80s during the Reagan era. I mean, it, to me, it just speaks for itself.
To your point about the Americana thing, I don't know if the scene is actually in the movie, but on the back of the Blu-ray, there's this Billy Greenbush and Dee Wallace, and it's like American Gothic,
yep,
kind of image.
That's a great point.
That's cool.
I don't know if that actually made the. I don't recall seeing it actually in the film itself, but I'm like, no, you're saying that, like, instantly. I went, I've seen an image, and I had to grab that. So
just no, you're right. That's you know, one of the co-producers, Rupert Harvey, that was his. He asked for that publicity still for New Line Cinema. They took that picture before the farmhouse was destroyed. And, you know, for him, that was a kind of a shining moment with what he was trying to capture and trying to, you know, play up, you know, a lot of people forget too, that era of early 80s, you know, a lot of the stuff that Americans feared the most was this idea of, you know, a Soviet invasion or nuclear war with the Soviet Union. You know, we got some great films, you know, Red Dawn, particularly from that era. Exactly. And it's like, you know, Critters is kind of a manifestation of that era. And I think it's, you know, serves itself as almost an important social time capsule in a way. We don't have, unfortunately, big hair bands anymore that are dominating the charts. But I thought they did a wonderful portrayal of what that meant at the time. You know, there's multiple scenes where there's even a great scene where Helen Brown catches herself. She puts her book down to watch the Johnny Steele video while she's alone. You know, so they not only made that great song, which Terrence Mann actually helped write and perform, but they used it effectively throughout the film. And anyone that was around at the, you know, the genesis of MTV and music videos and that era of rock and, you know, it captured it perfectly, and it made total sense to have one of the lead transmorphing body hunt, you know, bounty hunters play a big hair band, you know, lead vocalist. That was just brilliant.
Everybody's talking about this Johnny Steele. I gotta see what it's all about.
That's just. It's cool to hear all these details, but it's also depressing to think about the movie that could have been.
Yeah.
If all this stuff hadn't been cut out of it. Just, it's brutal sometimes thinking of the alternate universe where we got the full Critters experience.
Well, you bring up a great point, right? Because if we go the other direction, they originally sold the movie, the idea of the movie, to Roger Corman, who both Stephen Herrick and Brian Muir worked for, as well as a lot of the other guys. The editorial staff worked for Roger. One of the influencers on the script, but he was not credited, Patrick Rand, also worked for Corman at the time. And the original deal was Corman was going to give them $1 million to make Critters, but they would have to finance $500,000 themselves. So he was only offering up $500,000. And it was really by happenstance that Bob Shea and New Line got pitch this idea, and what he did to usurp Roger was to double the budget. And so, you know, on that side, it's like, hey, this is cool. We got the critters that exists. It could have been better, absolutely. But I really feel that if Roger Corman Studio would have done Critters for the $1 million, it probably would have looked a lot different. And perhaps we might not even be, you know, chatting about it 40 years later. It might not have had the same kind of impact. And Roger, at that point in time in the early 80s, was doing a lot of sci-fi horror films, Forbidden Planet, a couple other good ones. The cinematographer from Critters actually shot a couple of those for him. I think it was Galaxy of Terror and Forbidden Planet. So it like, who knows? Maybe it could have been really interesting as well, but perhaps it would have ended up being even cheesier than, you know, and who knows? Maybe the Kyotos would have never gotten involved. And, you know, I think the other thing that a lot of people miss too is, you know, a lot of the effects that we look back on and think, you know, hey, that was really cool they were able to do this, were really, really just happenstances of luck, particularly that farmhouse explosion, which they were able to shoot from three different cameras, is probably one of the most dramatic, you know, explosions in not only in horror cinema, but of the early 80s. I mean, they really detonated that house. And where the observation deck was, you know, half a mile away, they were pelted with, you know, 4x8 sheets of plywood and particles of the house that made it out that far. Wow. Is how big that explosion was. And there's no doubt, we watch it today, and, you know, I think the one thing we can all agree on is that explosion is just incredible to watch. But all of the,
yeah, to like action movies and stuff at the time, the explosion looks good compared to that, much bigger budget movies.
Totally, totally right. And, you know, a lot of the critiques on the critters and stuff, I think is largely unfair too. I mean, these guys were building this stuff for the first time with technology that didn't even exist yet at the time, and really pulled it off. To even control the critters' movements the way they controlled them, radio control, you know, aspects weren't really finessed yet on Critters 1. We will see advancements in that technology in both Critters 2 and definitely 3 and 4. But, you know, for what these guys were doing, and also being told halfway through production, hey, let's have a larger critter. Like, the biggest one they had earmarked was a 27-inch critter. They were not banking on a third man-sized critter until halfway through, you know? So, and through creative editing, I think they made it work. And there's very few scenes where the entire large critter that's ultimately played by Kevin Thompson is shown. But I think they do a great job of, and it speaks to the skill that Stephen Herrick had as, you know, this was his first directorial, you know, effort, but he was an editor, and I think he knew what coverage would work to kind of cut that together in a Jaws type sequence that Spielberg would have, you know, done. So I think there's a lot of credit that really needs to go just across the board, all the way down to those guys that either built the cow carcass, all the way up to, you know, the talents behind the critters themselves. And even the, you know, construction of the, of, like we had noted, the farmhouse and the detail put into the landscape around there. And of course, the homage to Invaders from Mars. You know, if you see even 15 minutes of that original Invaders from Mars, you will definitely see the nuances that is replicated in Critters, which I think is a great homage.
No, I'll have to check it out. Yeah, I've never seen that before. Good.
Yeah, I think that is just a problem, I think, with the public in general when it comes to movies, is you see, like, this is, it's a big name actor, it's a big name director, it's like, oh, this is their movie, and it's like nobody really thinks about the hundreds of other, sometimes thousands of other people who make the movie happen, especially like it's back in this time before, you know, you could just generate anything on your computer. The people who had to make these things happen on camera in real life especially with a limited budget. I mean, even you've seen movies from around this time, even with basically a blank check, have worse looking effects.
totally agree with you. I know a couple of the commentators were like, oh, there's nothing special about it. You know, it's not something that should be dusted off and considered as a cult classic. But you're totally right. You know, you look at the stock of talent behind this, you know, even down to, you know, some of the special makeup effects artists that did some of the aliens that were either in the beginning or in that unshot title sequence. Included people like John Criswell, who went on for, you know, with Jim Henson and did decades worth of work for, you know, Muppets and things like that. And the Kyoto's team of experts went on to be, you know, there's a couple great pieces of talent, you know, in Critters that went on. They're still working in Hollywood as top technicians for things like synthetic hair reproduction and things like that. A lot of them went on to work for Disney, not only Disneyland, but Disney Studios, doing a lot of their work and sculptures and things like that. So to me, I think the film brings a lot to bear. And we talked about the cast of talent, you know, Scott Grimes, who unfortunately I was not able to interview for the book, but I spoke to several times. You know, as a guy that we see on TV and have seen on TV for the past 20 years consistently, very talented guy. Nadine Vanderveld, although we don't see her in many productions in front of the camera anymore, she's an Emmy award-winning producer of a lot of child TV series and cartoons and things. And, you know, the whole stock of, you know, I know we didn't get a chance to talk too much about what Don Opper brought to the table, but not only was he working behind the scenes, writing some of the, you know, deeper dialogue and kind of character traits of Charlie, but he was a guy that had wrote numerous scripts in Hollywood, and including projects that Clint Eastwood was attached to in the 80s. Incredibly talented actor. He's not formally trained as an actor. He's an excellent writer. And there's just so many more individuals like that attached to Critters. We were joking about Stephen Herrick's career. You know, after Critters, he did Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh, that was the big one I missed.
Yeah. And that was a film that was, you know, the studios felt like didn't have a shot, and it sat on the shelf for like 2 years. And
somebody's got to do something about these studios, Matt.
Yeah. You know, like, I'm not kidding you when I tell you that at one point Herrick was walking around Hollywood offering to paint people's, you know, office interiors. He ran out of options, but then Orion Pictures picked up Bill and Ted's and they decided to take a risk on it, which they felt, and it turned out to be another cult classic. And, you know, really from that moment forward, he was a Disney regular. He did 101 Dalmatians for Disney, Mr. Holland's Opus.
That's the dog movie I was thinking of, not Air Bud.
And I think he did some Mighty Ducks films, maybe the first two, maybe more, you know? So, you know, you're talking about a guy that, yeah, that quote from, you know, these people critiquing, no one had any talent behind Critters, and you know, it's just fundamentally untrue. I mean, it's a great film. It's a great cast of you know, both cast and crew, in my opinion, that really gave us a lot of entertainment value for the, you know, next at this point 40 years.
Matt, you and I both glossed over his biggest directorial accomplishment, Three Musketeers, when it's all for one, it's all for love. as I believe Sting and Rod Stewart and Brian Adams sang famously.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, well, you know, we've come to find with these online reviews, there seems to be a disease spreading through the population of the ability to write endless reams and reams of garbage but not actually be able to read or research any of the things you're talking about. And it's just people just throw these,
not even watch the thing they're talking about.
I honestly, I do wonder sometimes if the people reviewing these movies ever actually watch them. or if they're just going off like the Wikipedia article, which by the way, Matt, if you want to do some editing in your spare time on there, they say that one of the alien bounty hunters is a shapeshifter.
In the official... Oh, God. God.
Wait a minute. One?
What? They won't shapeshift.
Oh, God.
Well, Jeff, let's see where the Krites fit on our Easter program. Matt, real fast, have you seen the SRS Cinema, the Polonia Brothers masterpiece, Peter Rottentail?
Oh, I have not seen that yet. I have not seen it yet.
Okay, because I was going to ask you, do you think Peter Rottentail can beat the Krites in a fight?
That depends. How much have they eaten, Jay? How big have they gotten?
And I think they're always hungry.
Well, I don't know. Honestly, I think maybe like one-on-one, easy win for Peter Rottentail. Two-on-one, I still think he could pull it off. But if we're getting to 3-4 Krites, I think that's going to go to the Krites.
I think the Krites might win. I think the Krites go above Peter Rottentail.
But also, Peter Rottentail, movie I championed at the time, Jay was very harsh on. And then he learned the error of his ways when he had to watch other movies.
I still would not say Peter Rottentail or Bikini Bloodbath Christmas are good movies.
No,
but I've seen much worse movies since watching those.
Now, see, we have this recurring thing on this podcast where we think we're in the lowest possible sub basement that you can get to, and then a movie breaks us through to a whole new level of the basement we hadn't found yet.
Like, I can't believe anything would be worse than Christmas Chronicle Massacre. And then we watch I Know What You Did Last Christmas. And sure enough, there's something that's maybe worse.
Well, you guys are in store then, because what I've experienced with the Thanksgiving horror subgenre, there's a new sub basement to kind of dig through down there too. Some truly, truly patience testing pieces.
Not what I want to hear.
Matt, I guess Jeff, you're in luck. Matt's here, so instead of shoving some garbage in our faces, we're gonna do something else for this.
Garbage day?
Huh?
No.
Matt, we got some questions for you. Have you got time to talk?
Absolutely. Fire away, guys.
All right. My first question. Why Critters after Christmas Horror? What was the why out of all the things? Why Critters?
Well, this is a great question. And, you know, honestly, the next book I was going to work on after Christmas Horror was I wanted to scale my efforts down to like a particular franchise. I had covered Silent Night, Deadly Night in the Christmas Horror book. And I thought, let me try to pick something that has maybe, you know, 2 to 5 films. And I really, really wanted to do the Slumber Party Massacre series. Ooh. I absolutely love the first one. I think it's a really important piece of horror history. And as I started to work on this, there was not a book in the works at the time. And as I contacted most of the cast and crew, many of whom were enthusiastic about it, I was contacted by at the time, their manager. He kind of managed all of the, at least the cast side, and asked me to kind of refrain from talking to the cast. They had a book in the works. And then he ended up getting a little bit aggressive about it about a week later. And I think one of the actresses had like just read my email the week after I talked to this guy, and he kind of like lost it. It left a bad taste in my mouth.
That's so unfortunate.
I love those films. I think they're incredibly important and were always a giant influence on me and my love of horror. And, you know, next up for me was Critters. So it was a very easy decision to kind of go that route. Again, it was kind of scoped, right? You know, 5 films and the miniseries, totally doable. Little did I know that doing just 5 films was as much work, if not more, than doing 250 films for the Christmas Horror book. So lots of lessons learned there. The really sad thing is at the end of the day, you know, I couldn't help myself. I reached back out to the manager of the Slumber Party Massacre folks. And this was after the beloved actor, you know, that played Russ Thorne in the first one passed away. And I engaged and said, well, what's the deal with this book? Like, you know, had I been able to interview these folks, the book would have been out, right? Because it was around the same time as the Critters work. And he tells me some story that, you know, the cast ultimately went away from him as a manager and it all fell through and, you know, typical, you know, bullshit stuff. But as an author and to other authors that might be listening, it just goes to show, right? You know, you really got to stick with it. If you know what your no joke timeline is, if you can get something done in 2 years or 18 months, you know, just do it, you know, stick with it, push through it, because these notions of someone else is doing it is usually bullshit, or it turns out to be a failed venture. And I'm not like disparaging other authors. I have no idea who was originally teed up, except you guys, of course. But you know, it just goes to show there's just so many like false promises in the industry. And I think we suffer from it as both fans and as historians that want to capture this stuff. And now we're stuck in a position where, you know, that great franchise, which has no literary companion. And now we have, you know, individuals passing away, both Roger Corman and the actor that played Russ Thorne. It just really sucks. It just bums me out. But at least I was able to tackle, you know, Critters. While I was able to, very, very sadly, was able to hear just this week that co-producer Rupert Harvey is in very bad shape.
Aww.
Was just put on hospice and was being asked for kind of prayers and support as he kind of enters that transitionary period. So, you know, again, very valuable lessons learned, right? Like if you want to contribute something for the community, I think it goes without saying, you really got to commit to it and kind of deliver to the best of your ability.
Well said.
Do you have a question, Jeff?
Yes. So I know you got a lot of irons in the fire. You're a very busy man, but when am I getting my retrospective on the franchise Leprechaun, one of the greatest horror franchises of all time?
Well, that's a great question. I love, just like you guys, absolutely love the Leprechaun series. I'd love St. Patrick's Day horror, and thank God we're getting more and more. You know, it might not be great, but we're getting more and more each year, which I think is excellent. Very sadly, the creator of Leprechaun passed away in the past few months, which is a real, real bummer.
Yeah.
And, you know, from a literary perspective, the sad part is that there is a book about the making of the original Leprechaun.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't believe that it's, you know, written by the creator himself, and it's kind of indirect coverage of a guy that kind of grew up in that era and worked at a theater at the time that remembers very vividly when Leprechaun came out. It's kind of a bizarre read, but I can't, you know, disparage it by any means, but it's available from Bear Manor Media or Bear Manor Press, one or the other. Very cool title and very cool cover art as well. But who knows? Maybe Leprechaun is in my future as well. It's a great, great series and franchise, as I know you guys love so much.
I hope it is, because I only take Matt Dupay movie coverage seriously. I'm not going to bother reading any other authors.
I was going to say, if not Leprechaun, can I pitch you on Return of the Living Dead? We can.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful film. I mean, what a, you know, 84 zombies, punk, just a wonderful, you know, for me growing up, that was another standout, just like Critters was. Return of the Living Dead played an outsized role in my love of horror cinema. It's just a master, you know, I would just easily call it a masterpiece, without a doubt.
Agreed.
Matt, since we've been talking a lot about little guys. I want you to rank the Krites, the Ghoulies, the Gremlins, the Munchies, and any other little guys that I missed. best.
Okay, so you know, for me personally, I'm a gigantic Critters fan. So for me, Critters one, Gremlins second. And oddly, I love Hobgoblins. I know it's not, you know, you want some critique about cinema, right? We could definitely level some at Hobgoblins and its sequel. But I thought the monsters were great. I love John Beekler and his, you know, the Ghoulies and Troll and all of his Full Moon features. So maybe tied with Hobgoblins is Ghoulies. And then at the bottom of the barrel is Munchies for me, even though it's absolutely hysterical. That'll come in, you know, just below Hobgoblins and Ghoulies for me.
There's another vicious alien race in the 80s, Jay, that is made up of primarily small guys. I think you're leaving out of this ranking. I mean, they toppled a technologically advanced empire. They fought for freedom in a hopeless situation.
You're going to say it.
They went toe to toe with the Imperial Stormtrooper Corps, Jay, the best of the best.
Oh, the Ewoks?
Yes. I mean, those are
talking about
some vicious little guys.
I mean, and Warwick Davis is one of them.
Exactly. And we're bringing it back to Leprechaun.
No, that's great. And, you know, Kevin Thompson from Critters was also instrumental in Ewoks. Ooh. And some of the standalone Ewoks films too, which just is great.
Wilford Brimley being in the Ewoks movie.
I'm pretty sure I've watched one of the Ewoks movies multiple times. There was, for anyone from Des Moines, or from the Des Moines area, where Mayhem Comics is now, in the strip mall next to it was a video rental store. It's now the Toro dealership. Do you know what I'm talking about, Jeff?
Yeah.
And that was the video store that my parents always took me to. And I probably rented Ewoks a handful of times. I also always either rented the Transformers movie where Orson Welles is Unicron.
Yes.
Or rented X-Men Night of the Pride, which was the animated series pilot for the arcade game. That never happened. But I would always rent one of those two things and then something else. And at least a couple times it was the Ewok movie, but also like once it was Disney's Black Hole, and that was a mistake.
God, love Orson Welles so much. You know, one of the,
oh, the French champagne.
Yes. Well, one of the last things anybody ever heard from him was a couple days before he died, he told his maid, she was asking him about what he was working on or whatever, and he's like, I don't know, I'm in Transformers or some such, I'm playing a planet, you know.
Another famous quote, it's about a bunch of toys fighting a bunch of other toys.
What a great man.
Jeff, do you have any other questions for Matt?
Just one, Matt. What do we got to do to make you a permanent third host on this podcast?
Oh man,
that's a busy man.
I know.
That's incredibly kind. You guys just let me know. I your guys' output is absolutely incredible, and the amount of coverage you guys get is very impressive to me. But I'd be more than happy to support you any way I can, in including some running commentary as you guys see fit.
All right, and we're doing Arbor Day next. So if you want to come on for Arbor Day, we'll talk about that like 2 weeks.
Awesome.
And then my last question is after Scary Little Christmas? I want to make sure I'm getting the name right. And we're here for the Krites. What's next for Matt Dupay?
So I've had a long standing project for, similar to Scary Little Christmas, but doing a deeper dive on Thanksgiving horror that I'm working through. So far, very happy with the progress made on that. And much to my surprise, you know, there's almost, I think, 50 films that I'm covering in that particular book. And I've got interviews for about half, if not a little bit over. And it goes back to, you know, similar to A Scary Little Christmas, early 70s forward. And there's a bunch of, you know, micro budget stuff, more contemporary, but there's some great classics like Blood Rage that's covered. I got to speak with the special makeup effects crew that did a lot of the gags on that, which are excellent. I mean, that movie is a definite B-movie cult classic for a very strong reason. I love it. But we have Eli Roth's, you know, Thanksgiving from only a few years ago, which is great. And of course, the fake trailer for it during the Grindhouse release too. So work continues on that one. And I'm very happy to report that I've been working on a deep dive of the 1986 film Neon Maniacs, which very was exciting. You know, a very much like a sleeper film from that era. It didn't get a wide theatrical release in 86, and it really kind of caught attention again as it entered a more contemporary space with it, you know, being available on Tubi for free. There was a Code Red Blu-ray in 2014, I think. And of course, it's out of print, super hard to come by. It's a beautifully shot film. There's 12 different main horror kind of icons. They're the maniacs in the film, with special effects by Alan Appone and his crew that have done numerous films, including a Return of the Living Dead, and a bunch of other classics. So some great special makeup effects work. Lilani Sorrell from Basic Instinct is one of the lead actors, and Alan Hayes from Friday the 13th Part 2, I do believe it's Part 2, is a co-lead. So great film. There's a rumor that a Blu-ray will be coming out fully restored with a bunch of extra features. Ooh. In the next, possibly even this year, if not definitely next year. So been working on that literary companion, which has been great, and just wrapped up, I think, the 25th interview just last week. So that manuscript is about halfway done. I think it'll be a lot of fun. If you haven't seen that film, I highly recommend it. And as you can imagine, it's rife with, you know, troubled production. Was shut down for a couple months, and then it got financing and kind of was able to be finished up. But if you're a big fan of those kind of more obscure cult classics from that era, like Spookies is another one that comes to mind, and Doom Asylum, Neon Maniacs kind of fits nicely in there. The writer of Neon Maniacs actually co-wrote Pumpkinhead, which is a bona fide horror cult classic.
One of Jeff's favorite movies.
I am a Pumpkinhead guy.
If you like that, then you'll definitely get some nostalgia points for Neon Maniacs too. I guarantee it.
Well, if I remember my friend Chris in high school ranting about it, I don't know exactly what the movie's about, but I know it involves the Golden Gate Bridge, some water-based monsters, and a climactic battle of the bands.
Yes, that's the perfect, you know, set of ingredients for this one. So I think you'll not only enjoy the film, but also the story about how they made it and how it almost didn't, you know, come to fruition is super interesting. And, you know, it's just another film that I'm grateful that did see the light of day, even though it was troubled. I think it is a lot of fun.
I do have one more question. Are you going to join us at the premiere of Dead Format?
Oh, give me more details.
We know nothing.
We know.
If and when it'll happen. Yeah,
we know a target time of year, and we'll get with you when we know more details.
That sounds excellent, guys. I think that'd be a great opportunity. And of course, I know, just like you guys, I can't wait to see the film itself. And of course, to support Mike Lombardo in his latest adventure. It's been really fun to watch it come to fruition, and it looks incredibly well done. So very exciting times. You know, I said it earlier, I'll say it again, what a time to be alive.
I just If Mike's listening to this, which I don't know how much time he has right now, so I doubt he is, but he said the other day in one of the things he released on Facebook that he had a feeling that this one was a special project. I have had that same feeling. I think this is going to be bigger than White Doomsday for sure.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I just saw him not too long ago, and he had mentioned, you know, some of the detailed work he was doing on some of the special makeup effects molds. And, you know, talk about someone so dedicated to craft and attention to detail. The stuff he was fretting over, it looked phenomenal. And there was just one thing that was off that just, you know, kept him up at night. And I'm just excited to see what he has to, you know, show us and the world once he wraps.
Yeah, that hand that he was either going to use for sex things or recreating the cover of House 2, the second story.
Yeah, that's right.
But no, we'll have to figure that out. Maybe get a live three-way record if Mike's not busy at the time.
Yeah. At least some red carpet stuff from us. Maybe we could stand outside and cover everybody who's walking in.
Great point.
Matt, now's the time. Plug your stuff. Go buy Matt's things. What are they, Matt?
Oh, thanks a lot, guys. So both of my books currently that are available, A Scary Little Christmas and We're Here for the Crites, are available at both Amazon and my website, MatthewDupay.com, MatthewDupee.com. From the website, you can get an autographed variety of either copy, Amazon. The prices will match, generally speaking. The only difference is the Amazon ones come unsigned.
Boo.
Yeah, if you want your thing to say, you're my favorite Christmas horror podcast.
Yes.
I mean, don't have yours say that. Listener, you're not making horror for the holidays. But if you wanted to say something like that.
I know. Mine said, Jay, you're my favorite host. And I was like, wow.
And Matt, I know you said you're in the writing phase right now. Do you have any conventions lined up that you people could see at?
Yeah, it looks like this the earliest ones that I know I'll definitely be at is going to be Crypticon Minnesota.
We might have to make another road trip.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just got locked in. It'll be my second appearance out there. That one is in early October. I believe it's the first weekend in October of this year. And then East Coast folks, there's Fright Books Festival, I think, in the second or third week of October in Howard County, Maryland. It's at a new venue. It's a much bigger venue space. And I believe that is a two-day show, and it'll be featuring mostly authors in both fiction, nonfiction, with a heavy, heavy focus on horror, and as well as some celebrities. I don't know who is going to be there this year. I might be a crowd from Troma, which will be a lot of fun. And I will say the Crypticon lineup in October is awesome. It's just as good as it was last year. In fact, there's some folks from Thanksgiving from Eli Roth that will be there, including the stuntman who played John Carver, the maniacal killer from the film.
Okay, so I'm looking right now. Alex Armbruster, Doug Jones, but more importantly, as I scroll down, Kevin Thompson, we just got done talking about
him. Yes, that's right.
Both of our boys, Eric Freeman and Robert Brian Wilson.
Oh, that's great.
I'll have to go back and see him again, see if he remembers us.
And there's going to be a Reanimator reunion currently. Currently booked are both Barbara Crampton and Jeffrey Combs.
Oh, I better bring my copy of Deep Space Nine for him to sign.
And so yeah, I mean, that's a reason enough to go to Crypticon. So
well, I mean, Matt's a reason enough to go to Crypticon.
Yeah. So Barbara Crampton. Hubba hubba, Barbara Crampton.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you guys, you know, if that was the first one you had attended last year. It was definitely my first one.
Yes.
And I was impressed. I thought it was a great lineup, great venue. And I'm excited to see this year that they kind of swapped out celebs, and the venue is still the same. It's quite large. So I think we'll be in store for another, great con.
Just as long as security is better. I don't want to see the creator of Gremlins just wandering the floor with the hoi polloi. Like they need to protect national treasures.
This is true.
Anyway,
quick Crypticon note. I told my wife, we were talking to you again. She couldn't remember your name, and that's why I referred to you at the beginning as Mr. Critters, because that's what she said earlier. She's like, what's his name? For the guy we met in Minnesota, Mr. Critters? Like, yes, the Mr. Critters is actually going to be on the show.
Oh, that's so good.
Listeners, if you want to get in touch with us, let us know your thoughts on Critters, on Crypticon Minneapolis, on anything else. Where you would rank the Ghoulies, the Gremlins, the Critters, and the Munchies, and the Hobgoblins. Send us an email, horrortheholidays@gmail.com. Get in touch with us on social media. We're almost all the places, at Horror4Holidays. That's Horror, the number 4 Holidays.
YouTube.com. Hit the subscribe button. Hit the bell. Listen to our audio backups. Listen to them over and over again so we could finally become a partnered YouTube channel and start exploiting you even more.
Yeah, let us get one of those cool little plaques that say the 1,000,000 watt or whatever.
Yeah. Tell us how many of Matt's books you're going to buy so we don't have to track down individual listeners and threaten their families again like we did last time.
Yeah, buy lots, guys. If you already have a copy, buy a second one just to be on the safe side.
I'm ordering a second copy.
What's the other thing? Leave us a review on your podcatcher of choice. 5-star reviews. We only read 5-star reviews. We don't care what you have to say if it's less than a 5-star review, even if it's the worst thing you've ever written about anybody ever. 5-star review. That's the only way we'll read it. And let us know you're a real sicko, someone who listens to this podcast. Title your review 0 stars if I could.
Indeed.
We're proud to be part of the Christmas Podcast Network. Matt, you'd have a great time. We'll try to get you in touch with Jerry D. Go on an episode totally talk about Christmas. Something cool for Totally Rad Christmas. Great time over there. All sorts of great podcasts.
I mean, we not only talked about one of the greatest movies of all time, Deadly Games, with him. We also all three got together in a room and blood beat off about another classic movie.
Oh, man, that mystical boinging. Jerry D and I were actually talking about a different surprise samurai movie earlier today. Hint for stocking stuffer coming up.
Ooh.
Otherwise, I think that's it.
That might be everything.
We'll see you next week for a stocking stuffer. I'm going to talk about a couple new release movies. And like I said earlier, we'll see you in 2 weeks for Arbor Day.
Yes, unfortunately, listeners, the FBI has found the location we were holding Matt Dupay hostage, and we're going to have to sign off.
All right. All right. He's coming out. Thanks, Matt.
Take care, guys.
Bye.